Tonight, I would like to have us look at the 10 kings of the end time and their leader, which is contained in Daniel chapter 7, verses 23 to 28, chiefly. The 10 kings of the end time and their leader. Now, in Revelation 13 and in other chapters, we've already gleaned much information about this, but now we will see more. And of course, as we live closer to the end, and again, we don't know how close we are to the coming of the Lord Jesus, but as we get close to the end, knowing these prophecies give us stability, because as we see movements come together and world governments arise, we do not get dismayed because we know this is prophesied. We don't join that group that thinks that God is dead because they feel that God has lost control in the world. No, we see that the more things head in the direction that we see in these prophecies, with a wild end of the world and a one-world government and an antichrist leader, we see that we're getting near the end times. Now, the 10 kings of the end and their leader. In Daniel 7, 23 and 24, and in this chapter, we have seen four beasts represent four successive empires: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Daniel and the angel are talking especially about the fourth animal, the animal of Rome, which seems to last to the end time through Western civilization. Daniel 7:23, thus he said, "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise." Now notice, the Roman Empire in its end era is pictured as a beast with 10 horns. And that's a lot of horns on a head, and I'm raising my 10 fingers to sort of portray it, but 10 horns. And the Bible says these 10 horns are 10 kings. Verse 24, "And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings." So in other words, again, we see clearly the secret of the mystery. We're not really talking about a great animal, but we are looking in figurative language, and the beast represents the final world empire, and the 10 horns are its 10 kings. And that's fitting. The horns of an animal are often its glory. They are attractive, and often they do the damage. Animals will bite and chew. They can kick, but generally horned animals do most of their damage with their horns. When a hunter hunts an animal, generally when they mount a trophy, I don't know, I've not been in that many hunting halls, but I've not seen a leg mounted. It's rare that you just see a leg, and somebody say, "Well, that's the right leg, that's my favorite piece." And you see on the wall just a right leg. Occasionally, jokesters have mounted the back of the animal and the tail. But that's rare. No true hunter worth his salt would mount the back of the animal. Some sort of wealthy jokers have put the front of an animal in one room, and around the other side of the wall put the back of the animal to give an illusion. And you might do this as the hunting season comes upon us. I'm not suggesting it. You discuss that with your family. But the cupola of the other night would be better than that idea. But the glory is the head and the horns. And generally, if a hunter hangs nothing else up, he will hang the horns to show the majesty and the greatness. And countries are often known by their leaders, because often the type of leader they elect or pick or allow to get to power is the kind of mind that the country wants at a certain time. Not always, but often. And so, number one, the 10 horns are 10 kings. Secondly, these are end-time kings. They're end-time kings. In Daniel 7:24, it says, they are 10 kings that shall arise. They were not living in Daniel's time, because he says they shall arise. So we don't think that Nebuchadnezzar was one of them and fetch around to find some others. When we go to Revelation, the last book of the Bible, and we've seen this on previous nights, but in Revelation chapter 17, we see, speaking of these same 10 horns, 17:12, 17:12 of Revelation, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet. So in Daniel's day, 600 years before Jesus, Daniel said they shall arise. In John's day, 7 centuries later, writing the Revelation at the end of Domitian, around 95 or 96 A.D., John writes, the 10 horns are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet. They don't exist yet. They have not received a kingdom as yet. Therefore, Nero, the Roman persecutor of Christians, in the year 64, when the fire broke out, Nero is not one of the 10 kings. Why? Because John plainly says, they have received no kingdom as yet. Nero had already received his kingdom and died in the year 68. So it wasn't these 10 Roman kings in the early days with the 10 imperial persecutions. And in fact, as we look through history, we've never seen them. No Bible commentator can name them. No one anywhere has ever come up with a good case naming who these 10 were. For the answer is, they have not yet arrived. They are in the end time, 10 kings. And the 10 horns of the beast, the 10 kings, they are not destroyed until Christ destroys the beast. And that happens in Revelation 19 at Armageddon. So what we have here is Daniel, 600 years before Christ, that's about 25 centuries ago. Think of that. 25 centuries back, Daniel, the Spirit of God, gave Daniel a picture of how everything would wind up. And of course, that's what the world is concerned with. And that God will win in the end. I don't know if I've said this before here, but if you had an awful accident at the turnpike, and you came out of it alive, you would hardly call home and say, we had an awful accident in the turnpike. And the person on the other end would say, I know, I heard there, it's been awful. How are you? Well, let me tell you about the leaves, how nice they looked in the turnpike. Well, nobody would be interested in the middle of the journey, or let me tell you what we ate for lunch at Howard Johnson's. Nobody would be interested in the middle. The end is what counts. And God has a lot of prophecy to give us hope. Some people live in happy times, some live in unhappy times. Some people have lived under a Hitler. And sometimes we wonder, how will it all end up? Well, God tells us. It'll end up with God victorious, with Jesus coming again. And it'll end up with these 10 kings arising, and God will destroy them. So these are 10 end-time kings. They'll be destroyed in Armageddon. They haven't appeared yet. Now, maybe they're alive. You see, if the rapture would occur, maybe they're the kings of Europe today, in Europe uniting in the common market. And as I said another night, maybe Bonnie Prince Charlie is one of them. Maybe Willy Brandt of Germany is another one of the horns. Maybe we could go and name them one by one. Maybe, and I'm not speaking after election, suggesting in any way that one of our candidates is worse than another or anything, but if the Lord was coming, maybe the U.S. would join this coalition, and maybe the President of the United States will be one of them. President Nixon. Or maybe, if the rapture doesn't occur soon, maybe it will be the next President of the United States who will join the European horns. Maybe he's a senator now. Maybe it's Agnew. Maybe it's Ted Kennedy. We don't know. Maybe it's neither one. Maybe it's someone else. Or if the rapture is a century away, then it's no one living on the earth yet. But if the rapture is near, and thus the tribulation is near, and these 10 will arise, all of these 10 may be living today, and all might have powerful positions. But we don't know them as the horns yet. And they're not named. And as I've said before, that they will arise has been predicted of old and reinforced in the book of Revelation. Daniel says it, John says it, through the Spirit of God. But the names of the 10 horns are not given, so it's anybody's guess whether the United States will join in or stay out. We don't know. Now, thirdly, these 10 horns, just to make the point clear, are part of the Roman Empire revived and expanded. You see, Daniel 7 goes through four beasts till the end of time, till the millennial kingdom. And in Daniel 8, we have a naming of some of them. And in Daniel 2, we have a naming of some. And in Daniel 2, we're told the first part of the statue, which corresponds to the first beast, is Babylon. We know the lion in Daniel 7 is Babylon. That was the first beast. We're not concerned with them now. They've passed. The second beast was a big bear. And Daniel 8 named that as Persia. And the Persians destroyed the Babylonians in 538. Or 536, and they ruled. And they're gone from the earth, the whole Persian Empire, with its capitals of Susa and Persepolis. And if there's anybody here tonight named Susan, her name traces back to Susa, the ancient capital of the Persian Empire. And the third beast in Daniel 7 was a leopard, showing Alexander the Great's swift conquest of the world, Greece, and that's faded. The fourth beast was Rome. But the ironic thing about Daniel 7 is that this beast somehow lasts until the end, till Christ's coming. And we look at Revelation 13, we see the same beast in Revelation 13 as the fourth beast in Daniel 7. Only there in Revelation, we're told he's now scarlet and he has seven heads. But all the other characteristics are identical. And that beast is killed by Jesus at Armageddon. So somehow, in a mystery, the Bible paints the Roman Empire as lasting until the end. Now we ask ourselves, how can that be? Well, usually we say 476 was the date of the fall of the Roman Empire. But that was really no big battle. Just a Germanic king stabbed Romulus Augustus and sort of took over. The Roman Empire never was conquered by any one country. You see, Babylon was completely conquered by Persia. Persia was completely conquered and the world was filled with Greece. Greece was taken over and the world was filled with Rome. But Rome cracked in pieces. Rome split in pieces into an Eastern and Western Empire 300 years after Christ. And then the Vandals came, with such a devastation. They came in around the year 430s after Christ. The Vandals came with such destruction, they burnt up North Africa, which was civilized, that we still speak of anybody that destroys without any purpose. We say they're a Vandal. But the Vandals were a nation from the north that came out of the north country. The Teutonic tribes on horsebacks and wild, and they rode through Europe and through Spain. They went into North Africa. They crossed in boats. And they so burn up North Africa. When St. Augustine, named in church history books as the greatest Christian in the first five centuries, of course God will make the final, award of that. But Augustine lay dying, and he had Psalm 32 written on the wall in the room that he was dying in. And all around in North Africa, which was civilized, fires were burning as the Vandals were burning all of North Africa. We still, again, speak of a Vandal as somebody that just destroys for the sake of destroying. But the Vandals never took the whole Roman Empire. They just took a little piece. In fact, they didn't even take a little piece. They just burned a little piece. The Huns came in. And in the year 410, and the Goths came in. The Goths, G-O-T-H-S, the Goths came in, and in the year 410 A.D., the city of Rome was invaded for the first time in 8 centuries. Now, will America last that long? Think of that. The city of Rome invaded the first time in 8 centuries, and in the middle of the dark night, the writer said they heard horns and trumpets, and thousands upon thousands and thousands of thousands of Goths rode in on horseback and were burning and destroying and riding through. But they didn't really take over everything. And Clovis came with the Franks. And he heard about Christianity and he decided to have his whole army baptized. And since he was the conqueror, he named the mode of baptism. And he said they'd ride through the river on horseback and everybody would be baptized. And since he had the sword and he had a big army, the church said, well, that'll be all right. Now, again, don't blame your pastor. He wasn't there. But Clovis and his army, they rode across the river and they declared they were baptized into Christianity. And they settled in France. Later, Charlemagne was from that line. But the Roman Empire was never completely taken by any one group. In fact, in the year 1870, now think of this, 1870, now that's not too far away. 1870, now we're getting real near. In 1870, Italy and Germany were still known as the Holy Roman Empire. It had been destroyed, but the name lived. When Martin Luther was accused of heresy, he appeared before Charles V in 1520. And Charles V was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, how old is Germany? 1870 is the beginning of Germany, modern Germany. How old is Italy? 1870 with Garibaldi and Mussolini is the beginning of modern Italy. Hitler destroyed Germany before it lasted 100 years as a nation. And so, before that, they called it the Holy Roman Empire. So Rome was broken and cracked and smashed, but still the Roman law and the civilization endured. And it seems from Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 that in God's eyes, and God is the great historian, God is the historian without prejudice who judges nations and individuals. God pictures this fourth animal, the Roman Empire, living till the end. So it seems, and we can confirm that, in that Rome has never been conquered by one group. The Russians have never conquered all of Europe. And so now many people have said, well, Rome will be revived. Rome will live somehow at the end. And some people said, oh, that's silly. This business of Rome being revived and Israel getting back to Palestine, that's silly. But now suddenly we're living in a day when it's not silly because it's happening. You see, it's not that we're that smarter, we're that much smarter than Bible commentators who a century ago said it was silly. But we no longer can say the idea of Israel being back in Jerusalem is silly because it's happened. We no longer say the idea that Europe will get together in some sort of revived Roman Empire, a united Europe. That's not silly. It's true. And those people that saw it were correct. And we said on other nights, we see the United Europe symbols in the cars. We see All Europe TV. We see in 1980 the European dollar to be introduced. And right now in our own time, we see the common market with Europe having a greater gross national product than the United States or Russia. So suddenly, Europe comes together at the same time when Israel's back in the land. Now, there are to be 10 kings. Again, people argue ferociously, will the United States join in? And then is this fourth beast, perhaps instead of called Rome, maybe we should call it Western civilization? Well, it's hard to tell now. If the Lord tarries 50 years from now, we should know more than now. If the Lord tarries. But in any case, Europe is uniting, and the 10 horns would seem to be coming together. And we remember what the Lord said in Luke 21:28, when you see these things begin to come to pass, look up, lift your head, for your redemption draweth nigh. Things are coming close. Now, the next point, my fourth point. Another king shall arise, he will be the Antichrist. An 11th king shall come. The 10 are a united Europe, perhaps with the U.S. Another king shall arise. Notice in Daniel 7:24. Another king shall arise, and he shall arise after the 10. 7:24. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise. And another shall arise after them. After them. After them. In other words, at the end time, 10 nations will be in a coalition. Just as right now we have a 10-nation common market. Again, 3 nations may quit tomorrow. 8 nations may join. But at the end time, it looks like there'll be 10. That could be it would seem to be a literal 10. But we have to be careful. It might be a representative 10 for a whole bunch of them. But I think we can presume it's 10. But after these 10, in some sort of coalition, another king, another personage, some man somewheres, or who knows, some woman. But some ruler shall arise after them. This will be the Antichrist. Notice this next ruler shall start small. Chapter 7, verse 8. I considered the horns and beheld, in other words, Daniel says, boy, I was looking in my dream at these 10 horns. See, he's seeing a dream of animals and horns, and then God at the end, through an angel, explains, this is how nations and kings will arise at the end time. You know, history isn't always that interesting. And even as I talk, while some are interested, somebody might be falling asleep. Some people like history, some don't. But God was the great teacher. God gave it to Daniel in such an exciting way that Daniel could not forget anything about it. Daniel saw it in wild animals, and he saw kings in horns. And it was so frightening in verse 28 of this chapter. Daniel says, hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me. My countenance changed in me. In other words, he said he got sick over it. It was so frightening to him, he got sick over it. But now notice in Daniel 7, verse 8, he said, I'm looking at the horns in my vision. And he sees these 10 horns, which are 10 kings, and behold, something happens. There came up among them another horn. But he says, another little horn. Among the 10 horns, a little horn starts to grow out. And what does that teach us? It teaches us that the Antichrist will rise slowly. He'll be a little king for a while. In other words, the Antichrist won't be one of the 10 great kings. And suddenly the greatest of them all will take over, as we would have guessed. No, it'll be somebody a little in the background. Maybe he'll be maybe he'll be the treasurer of a nation. Maybe he'll be a general. Maybe he'll be a statesman. Maybe he'll be a senator. Maybe he will be a nobody. A nobody that just starts to talk. And some people start to listen to him. But he'll be little. He won't be one of the big kings. He'll be a little person, and some people hear him and they'll say, he won't amount to anything. He's crazy. You know, when Hitler started, Hitler sounded crazy. You know, we say men are important for two different reasons. Either they're important because they've contributed something great or some great idea. They're innately important. Or they're not really important, but because so many people believe them and listen to them, they get important. Hitler shouldn't have been important. He was crazy. Hitler said, you know what we need? Hitler had the idea, you know, blonde-haired people are smarter than dark-skinned people and especially smarter than Jews. Hitler said, you know, the reason the world isn't really doing well is because the Jews are running the money and the blonde-haired people in Central Europe, they're the smartest. They ought to be running the world. Hitler said, what we've got to do is get rid of the Jews and start putting the people who are supreme, who are the Aryan race, they're the ones who should rule. And the sooner we get the Jews rid of and the Aryans in command, we'll start to have a good earth. Well, that was crazy. And some people probably heard him and said, well, that's stupid. That's not important. I'm not going to waste my time. But he became important because people started to listen to him. And suddenly he had ideas, well, we'll all wear brown shirts and we'll beat up some people that don't listen. And he was a good talker and pretty soon more people were listening to him. Suddenly he started to get elected to office and to the party. And he demanded to be chancellor and they all laughed at him. He demanded the next election to be chancellor and they thought he was crazy, but he had more brown shirts. He demanded to be chancellor the next election. They still said he was crazy, but he had more brown shirts. Then the next election, he still demanded to be chancellor. They all still said he was crazy. But this time he had enough elected representatives that they couldn't form a government without some of his men. And he said he wouldn't form a government unless he was chancellor. They finally said, well, let's give him a try. And he climbed up. Then he said he wanted to be president too and get rid of Hindenburg. And they said, nobody can be president and chancellor. You're crazy. But then finally Hindenburg was out of the scene, and he got some more votes and some more brown shirts. And they said, we'll make him Führer, president and chancellor, and change the Constitution, and let's try his methods. Let's put the Jews in concentration camps and put the Protestant pastors in concentration camps and get rid of them. He became important not because he was really important. He'll listen to him. Who would have dreamed that the crazy guy down the street in Berlin would have been the world ruler, almost. Well, the Antichrist will be something like that, perhaps a little smarter than Hitler, a little more credible, because Jesus said, if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived, which would be the tribulation saints after the rapture. But anyway, he'll start out as a little horn. So at first, nobody will know him. It's not until the abomination of desolation in the middle of the week when he enters the temple and commits some great sin will people know for sure who the who the Antichrist is. So he's little, he comes after the ten, and chapter 7, verse 24 says he'll be different than the ten. 7:24. And the ten horns out of the kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be different from the first, that is, from the first bunch, the first ten. Now, we don't know what this means, except when it happens, it'll be true. Somehow, he'll be different. He will have some quality, the Antichrist. Maybe it's the fact that Satan is in him, that he has a cause and a burning zeal, that he's always right, that he knows where he's going, that he's sure of it, that he's pushy, that he always wins, that he's successful, that he's never in doubt what to do. He always knows what to do. He has an answer. He's definite. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's something else. But somehow, people will notice he is different. Just like Jesus was different in righteousness, this one will be different, perhaps in complete wickedness. But he'll be different from the other ten horns. We don't know what that means. It could mean anything. Could mean they're white, he's black. Could mean they're Aryan, he's an Arab. He's a Jew. Could mean they're men, he's a woman. She's a woman. Could mean they can see, he's blind. Or it could mean he's filled with Satan. We don't know, or a lot of these things. Or maybe there'll be kings of a nation. There'll be kings of ten nations. Maybe he'll be king of a religion. A religious leader. Maybe that's the answer. We're not told. All of these are possible. Maybe he'll be the Pope or the head of the World Council of Churches. But somehow, for some reason, when it happens, he will be diverse, different from the ten, from the first ten. He'll be different. It's nice to be different, if it's different in a good way. Now, next he shall become involved in a power struggle with three of the kings, and he shall emerge victorious. 7:24. Says in the last words in 7:24, and he shall subdue three kings. See, he starts out little and starts to get big. And you know, as long as you're little, there's no trouble. Except with other little people. You know, tiny tots, if they fight, they usually fight tiny tots. But now this little horn starts to get big. Starts to get big. And there's a power struggle. He and three horns apparently don't get along. Apparently three of the kings are going to say, look at him. He's different. Again, we don't know how it's going to be different. Maybe they'll all be professed Christians and he'll be a Muslim. Or maybe he'll be an atheist. Or maybe they'll all be atheists and he'll say he's a Christian in an upside down sort of world. We don't know. But as he gets bigger, three of them will say, hey, he's going to take over. Just like Hitler and Stalin or all these dictators. You read the story of Russia, and you see, these are men are fighting, but a couple get killed off, and this one lives. Then these men fight, and a couple more get killed off, this one lives. The same with Rome. Julius Caesar was fighting, and then there's the first triumvirate, the second triumvirate, and there's Pompey and Crassus and Mark Antony, and they get killed off. And Mark Antony and Octavian fight the other two and kill them. And then Mark Antony and Octavius, the two winners, they fight each other, and Octavian wins, becomes Augustus Caesar. It's like a tournament, only instead of in basketball, it'll be with kings and for life and for world rule. We may see, or the tribulation saints may see, some of the arguments on TV at the UN. We don't know. But somehow, three of the men, three of the kings, and maybe one is Bonnie Prince Charlie. See, maybe he'll be good. And he'll say, this guy's wicked. I won't have him. Maybe seven will be wicked and three will be righteous. And the three righteous will say, hey, this is a wicked monster. We're not going to let him get so big. He's getting big. We better stop him. And there's going to be a power struggle, but the Antichrist will win. He shall subdue, verse 24, the three kings. And notice, he shall completely destroy the three kings that stand in his way after the power struggle. Chapter 7, verse 8. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Now you see, in this power struggle, the three horns that fight him are plucked up by the roots. Now we understand what that means. If you have some crabgrass and you just trim the leaves, you'll have that crabgrass grow again. But if you really get angry at that crabgrass, you run out and you get your little digging tool and you spade it up by the roots, because you know if you take it out by the roots, it won't come back. And so we say, what does the Bible mean? Because it says clearly the horns are kings, that in this struggle, three of them are plucked up by the roots. In other words, Daniel sees the little horn have a fight on the beast, the final world empire. He sees the horns fighting with each other, and he sees this little horn pull three of them out by the roots. That means he really destroys them. No, all traces of them. Now, we don't know how that'll happen. It may come by vote. He may have them voted out of their country or out of the confederation. They may be ashamed, just like Khrushchev. And Khrushchev, once Khrushchev lost, he was out completely, and he was a nobody. Or, you know, in Russia, they have effaced Stalin statues. They renamed Stalingrad to Leningrad. They really wanted to get rid of the Stalin image. They took Stalin's body and moved it. Maybe the three kings will actually be killed. Maybe there'll be a firing squad and they'll be killed, and their families will be hunted down and put in prison and killed. Or maybe there'll be a war. There might be actually a war with shooting and planes. Maybe even atomic bombs. We don't know whether it'll be vote or by war. But somehow, there's going to be a power struggle, and Antichrist, the little horn, as he gets big, will fight three of them and win. And he will completely destroy the influence of the three. They'll be out of his way forever, so they can't hold him back any longer. The three kings that oppose him will be gone. So he's rising. He's rising. He's getting bigger. Now after this, the ten kings, which would be the three replacements for the three that are lost, his puppets, his friends, after this, the ten kings will completely yield their will to this king, who will be the personification of the empire. Revelation 17, verses 12 and 13. You see, after a big battle, other people, they either join the fight or they give in. And that's what's going to happen. Revelation 17, 12 and 13. Revelation 17, 12. And the ten horns which you saw, these are the same ten horns as Daniel and the same beast. Revelation 17, 12. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. And the beast is ruled by this little horn. He is the Hitler, the Stalin, the Lenin, the leader of the empire. Now these shall give, these have one mind. Now what does it mean they have one mind? Well now, if the church would consider, this church would decide to build a cupola up here in front of the altar, which I suggested the previous night, which apparently some are now moving and donations are coming in to the pastor. And remember I said when you have about 75,000, you should then start to draw plans. You want to have a cupola like they do in Rome. You want to have a little one where you can just come in and build it yourself. But well, now, if you came to a church meeting and somebody said, hey, you know, a cupola is really a good idea, but a lot of people said, no, we don't want it. No, we don't want it. We don't want to give for it. And we think it'll look bad and it confuses people. They won't know it's a Christian church. We don't want a cupola. Other people say there's nothing wrong with that. Top of it. Well, we would say, well, they're all arguing. They're all arguing. We better not go ahead. That's what I was told when I was young. If everybody's arguing, well, best not to go ahead, generally speaking. But sometimes everybody agrees on a project. Sometimes you say the whole church was of one mind. Everybody agrees. Everybody's convinced. We want to do the same thing. Well, that's the picture here in Revelation 17, 12, and 13. After the three kings are destroyed, the other seven and the three replacements, either through fear or wickedness, they join in. And they all have one mind with a little horn. They're all anti-God. They're all behind him. Like the people, after Hitler had all that fighting, suddenly all the leaders were of one mind. And it really wasn't until they started to lose the war drastically that they turned against Hitler and started to plot Hitler's life. Because they felt that Hitler was fighting when they should have surrendered. And they were just going to lose all of Germany's young men if they kept up in all the cities. But as long as Hitler was winning, everybody was for him. And these shall have one mind now. And this will be true in the end time. Notice the details God is telling us, and I think they're fairly found in the Bible, of the end time. Now notice a few more things. This person shall be a great orator. Daniel 7, verse 8. He's going to be a great speaker. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn there were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. A mouth speaking great things. A big mouth. A mouth speaking great things. Daniel was surprised when he saw this vision. Because what Daniel saw suddenly, when he saw these horns on the animal, was this one horn that started to grow up on the animal. Now, if you've had a dream, and tonight if you dream about an animal, and if there's anybody here, a hunter, getting excited about the hunting season, maybe there's a hunter here who's already having dreams of deer with horns. But have you ever had a dream where the horns had eyes and started to talk? Well, Daniel had a big dream. That's what he saw. And he says, this horn started to talk. Got bigger, it had a fight with three horns. It has a big mouth. That means the Antichrist will be a great orator, a great speaker. That fits in with world dominion, as we see in Revelation 13. With TV, and there's TV in Africa, there's TV in Palestine, there's TV in Russia, and at the Olympics, the whole world saw the things often at the same time. One man who would really be a great debater, that's why the presidents are a little frightened. Because one good talker might be able to win a whole presidential election just by one good debate in 1 hour. And we realize that the man who's the best talker may not necessarily be the best president. And some people are frightened. Because two candidates may get together in front of the United States in 4 years from now, and one, by virtue of being a good talker, may win his party's nomination, he might win the presidency. Because we can all listen now. It's not like the old days where they could say Douglas was a powerful speaker, or William Jennings Bryan, and maybe 2,000 people could hear him in the right arena. The presidential candidates today, they talk to almost 200 million. And a world orator, the Antichrist, could speak to billions at the same time and convince them. And he'll be convincing, because remember, Jesus said in Matthew 24, that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived. He's going to be convincing. And you know, Hitler was a great talker. And I heard some records of Hitler's speeches, and I've read some of Hitler's speeches. And Lenin, the great communist leader, who really was the great mold of communism, the molder of communism, Lenin, Hitler and Lenin both had a similar style of talking. They both were capable of giving a fantastic amount of statistical evidence for whatever they maintained. And you read Hitler's speeches, and Hitler wasn't just a loud guy shouting in the wind nothing. Hitler had evidence and statistics, and he'd quote fact after fact after fact, and how many square miles were in Germany, and how many square miles were in the Ruhr, and how many square miles were in Poland, and how much it took to feed a German, and how much it took to feed here, and how many Jews there were in Germany, and how much money the Jews were making, and how much money the Germans were making, and how many United States people there were, and fact after fact after fact after fact. And at the end of a Hitler speech, he had so much evidence that unless you wanted to write a book or search for a month, how could you ever refute him? You read Lenin's writing. And Lenin was a mass producer like Hitler of literature. And Lenin's literature has fact after fact after idea and claim after claim after claim that it's a mountain to hold back. And with both Hitler and Lenin, you say, oh, well, what can we say? Who knows? Okay, we'll do it. An avalanche of speech and writing. And the Antichrist will be something like that. And he'll have a big mouth, and Daniel notices his mouth. He'll also, notice, be crafty. Chapter 7, verse 8, he has eyes, like the eyes of man. Daniel noticed his eyes. Jesus Christ, in Revelation 19, comes with eyes as fire. What does that mean, Christ comes with eyes as fire? It means his eyes have a supernatural quality that can see into the soul of man. Eyes, fiery eyes of judgment. He can see everything. That's the picture of Revelation 19 when he comes. And Revelation chapter 2. The sword comes out of his mouth, power in his words, the eyes of fire. Well, Daniel notices this man's eyes. The Antichrist will be wise. He'll be able to see trends and movements and know how to capitalize on them. He'll be crafty. Notice his oratory will be blasphemous. Chapter 7, verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High. He will be a blasphemer. Now, you know, we cannot avoid saying this. You know, many people say, you know, we say the times, it seems like the Lord's coming. And then people say, well, you know, if you were living in the time of the Revolutionary War and you heard the British were coming, and you might hear that women are wearing skirts above the ankles now, and women are bathing with bare wrists, and you can see their whole faces, and you can see their bare feet, you might think, well, that's shameful, and it's awful, and it seems like it's the end times. And there's a stamp tax now, and a tax on tea. Where will it ever end? But, you know, you honestly have to say it really is worse today than that. You know, you really have to say it. Ingersoll used to make some remarks about God, and he was a world-known skeptic. But, you know, people who speak against God and say, I don't believe in God today, well, you just walk by them. Years ago, that would make the news. It doesn't make the news anymore. It's the opposite. A pious man makes the news. I don't know. You know, Nixon has had attended prayer breakfasts with Billy Graham. And they said after McGovern's loss, he said they were going back to the hotel to have a prayer meeting. Now, you know, we're not God. And sometimes we disagree with some of the things both of them have propounded and did. But at least in America, until this day, both candidates professed to be pious men. And even though, you know, we really feel that on certain things, sometimes they're mixed up and disappointing. Both of them really professed and acted like pious men in certain respects. But you know, that's not in the, we don't know what's going to happen in 4 years. I don't know yet if or how bad it would hurt a man to say if he interviewed by Meet the Press, well, I don't really believe in God. You know, if they said, Mr. Candidate, you're candidating for the highest office in the United States. Are you praying? Are you hoping that God will help you if you're elected in the next 4 years? Well, it's usually thought to be good for some votes if you say, yes, I'm counting on the Almighty. I don't know, though. Do you think he would lose the election if he said, I don't believe in God, we'll have to help ourselves and pitch in? The way the U.S. is going, I don't think he'd lose anymore. But at least in Russia, we know that the leaders openly deny God. In China, the leaders openly deny God and kill Christians. North Vietnam, they openly deny God. In Chile, in taking communism, in Cuba. Cuba, it's a little different. They're sort of quiet. And Chile a little bit too. But communism denies God. That's part of communism. And this world leader will openly, apparently, deny God. He'll be blasphemous. He'll say things that will be sinful about God. But apparently, nevertheless, the world will be hardened enough. They'll say, well, he's still a good fella because we need a strong man. Times are tough. And we need a man to really stand on people and to get his way done. Or we'll all perish. So he's going to be blasphemous. Not only that, he will be a persecutor. 7:25 and 7:21. I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. You see, he gets bigger, 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 fights with three of them. He takes control and he makes war with the saints. Chapter 7:25. He shall speak great words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints. What does it mean? He shall prevail against the saints, and he shall make war against them, and he shall wear them out. He shall be a great persecutor of anybody turning to God. A persecutor. Notice also, 7:25, he shall decide to change times and laws. 7:25. It says he shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. Now, what will that mean? We can guess. We may be wrong. But we know that it irritated Lenin, it irritated many of the communists to have a seven-day week based on the idea of the religious creation in Genesis. And the Lord arose on the first day of the week. So we, like the apostles, meet for church on the first day of the week. Suppose somebody declares, and here's my guess. Suppose somebody declares we're going to have a 10-day week. It'll be more efficient. We'll have 4 work days and then a rest day. Then we'll have 3 more work days and 2 rest days. And that'll be our cycle in a 10-day week. Day 1, 2, and 3, we work. Day 4, we work. But day 5, we rest. Day 6, 7, and 8, we work. But 8 and 9, we rest. 3 days rest out of every 10. That would sound good to a lot of people. There's talk now of a 4-day work week. There's even talk by 2000 of a 3-day work week. There's a lot of unemployed people. It's thought it'd be better to have everybody work 4 days than have some work 5 and some work none. It's thought by some it'd be better to have everybody work 3 days and have no one unemployed. Well, a lot of people like that. In fact, I kind of think a lot of people here, and I don't think it's necessarily immoral, but I think a lot of people here wouldn't mind working 10 hours a day for 4 days and have 3 solid days off. I think that'd be sort of nice. But, you know, if that happened, that would really throw our church calendar into a tailspin. Suppose the Antichrist, for the good of society, so that the workers can have, maybe it'll be 3 work days, 2 rest days. Or 6 work days and 4 rest days. Some people would like that better. Different shifts. Or maybe everybody will work another shift. 5 work days, 5 rest days for you. 5 work days for the other crew. 5 rest days. That would be really the leisure life. But now, If that became law, like we've already made now in the United States, and I'm not saying everybody's wicked, you know, but, you know, we celebrate George Washington's birthday on a day that's not his birthday to make the three-day weekend. We do all these things. Suppose that we did this. You know, a lot of people, I think, would say, well, boy, I like that idea, having 5 days off in a row. I'm going to vote for it at the factory. Oh, Kaufman will work something out. Kaufman will work something out. The elders will work something out. They'll manage. So let them have a service once every 5 days. You know, they can make it to the church once every 5 days. That'd be better. But how does that throw off, you know, their Lord's Day, the church calendar? That'd really be a problem. Well, for a while you could say, we won't submit. We're going to have the church every 7 days. Then people say, well, I've got to work. Got to work. Can't have church every 7 days. I've got to work. I'll make it this time, but for the next 8 times I can't make it. It doesn't work out with the calendar. How much can you fight the calendar? You have a few policemen, a few firemen, and the children have to go to school. Well, you say, you know, somebody says, Pastor, I've kept my child out of school for 3 days. Every Sunday we've done it, but now they say they're going to leave her down if I keep missing. Or they're going to report me. They say she's truant. I've got to send her. And the whole church calendar gets thrown off. Well, something, maybe that'll happen. That's my guess what will happen, because there's talk of it already. But we'll see. But somehow the Antichrist is going to change times. Can't change day and night too easily, but you sure can change the religious calendar, and that would really wreck the churches. What a problem. Well, praise the Lord. Finally, Daniel 7:26, the Antichrist shall be destroyed. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. He will be destroyed. 27. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. And notice the Antichrist's kingdom will last for 3.5 years. 7:25. Says, and they shall be given into his hand a time, 2 times, and a half time. 3.5 years. That corresponds with Revelation 13:5, where it also says he'll reign for 3.5 years or 42 months. So what do we see now that we're done? And again, Heavenly Father, we thank thee that we are on the victorious side through Jesus Christ our Lord, the one who purchased us with his blood. And we thank thee for this time together. We thank thee for your telling us what will come to pass in the end times. And we thank thee in Jesus' name. Amen.